So I'm coming to Radcliffe Hall from a very particular angle. I had a chance a few years ago to spend several months in Austin, Texas, at the Harry Ransom Center there. It's a big literary archive if you're interested in early 20th century literature and history. It's an archive that has rich materials for you. And in particular, what was of interest to me is that they have most of the material that was left behind after Radcliffe Hall's death. So Hall died in 1943, and it's quite interesting what happened with her estate. So all the writings, notes, papers that she left behind were basically left to her partner, Una Troubridge. And Radcliffe Hall actually told Troubridge to destroy all of her papers. So that was her instruction, but Troubridge went beyond Radcliffe Hall's wishes. She destroyed some papers, but she kept the bulk of the material that Radcliffe Hall left behind. And there's an interesting story here. Troubridge herself held onto the materials. She then died in Rome in 1963, and she just left those materials with a friend there. And they were just kind of stuffed into suitcases and left in a basement in Rome. The son of the friend inherited them, and they were just sitting there. And then in the late 1990s, the Harry Ransom Center, it's a very rich archive, they acquired these papers, and that's where they are today. So Sally Klein in particular, who has written what I think is the best biography of Radcliffe Hall to date, has looked at some of these papers from a biographical angle, but no one has really looked at them from a literary or historical perspective, going beyond what they might tell us about Radcliffe Hall's life and the kind of chronology of her life. So I was able to do that. I spent several months there working through these papers, and it gives you such an interesting kind of intimate view on an author's life, and that's what I'll try to share with you today. That material has also recently been published in this book with Manchester University Press. You can have a look later. As all academic books, I was talking to Cheryl about this just a second ago. Right now it's ridiculously expensive, but it will come out in paperback, so that has been agreed with the publishers and the estate. So it might take a while, but if someone's interested in reading it and you can't get it through a university library, then it will be there in a while for you to have a look at that as well. So to give you a bit of background, I always just assume that people know Radcliffe Hall, and I gave a talk to it's called the LGBTQ Plus Society at Exeter, the students group there a few months ago, and when I asked who has heard of Radcliffe Hall, some of the English students had heard of her, but not everyone knows her. So just a kind of quick sense of who she is, a bit of background here. Radcliffe Hall, I mean, the main reason, sometimes the only reason why people know her is because she wrote one single book, The Well of Loneliness, that many of you will know. You might have read it, you might have tried to read it, you might not have gotten to the end. As I said, it's not the most popular book. Some people say it's too long, some people say it's very badly written. But it has, for better or worse, become a lesbian classic. If it's not the lesbian classic, it's a really important, crucial book in lesbian history. And I doubt that this book would have that kind of status and significance. I don't think anyone would really care about that book that much if it hadn't been banned and censored as obscene in Britain in 1928. Otherwise, I think it wouldn't really be that remarkable as a book. So it's very interesting. It has an interesting place in literary history, but also in the history of sexuality, because you can make the case that as often censorship doesn't really work, and because of the trial and the scandal and the spectacle that happened as a result, loads of people really wanted to read the book, and French copies were imported illegally and sold under the table. It was still available in the US, so people did read it and really wanted to read it. There was huge debate about lesbianism as a result of this. And so even though people don't necessarily like the book, it has played a crucial role in popularizing a very particular model of thinking about lesbian desire and gender identity as well. So if you don't know the book, very briefly, it's about a very masculine woman called Stephen Gordon. She falls in love with other women. She serves in the First World War. She's very heroic and brave. That's the way she's depicted. She then becomes an author later on, and people dislike the book for a number of reasons. One of them is that, as the title indicates, the book very much draws attention to the suffering, the loneliness of Stephen Gordon. It's not a very uplifting read, not very affirmative, not very celebratory. And particularly at the end, that's what people really don't like, is that Stephen Gordon basically decides to give up on her relationship. She gives up on her great love so that that woman can go on to marry a man and live a more conventional life. And Stephen ends up heartbroken and alone, but able to focus on her writing and her novels. So there's that at least. What is very significant about the novel, I think, for historians of sexuality in particular, is the fact that Hall, as I said, draws on a very particular way of describing and making sense of lesbian desire and gender identity. And here, John Ellington Symonds comes into play because Hall, in that book, draws specifically on the sexological category and label of the sexual invert, which she gets from this book that was initially co-authored by Havelock Ellis and John Addington Symonds. And she's drawing on these sexological and to some degree medicalized views of homosexuality. And it's quite interesting. So Symonds and Ellis co-authored this book in the 1890s. I should say as an aside that when I'm not working in literature, I'm also a historian of sexual science, so I've published on Symonds as well, so if you want to talk about him later on, that's fine, and I'm happy to try and answer whatever questions you might have. But his relationship with Ellis is very interesting. The book goes through several editions. The edition that Radcliffe Hall read is probably the 1915 third edition of Sexual Inversion. By that time, Symonds' name had been removed from the cover. In particular, his contributions about ancient Greece that were mentioned earlier, most of that material was taken out of the third edition. So, but still, I think Symonds played a really crucial role in shaping that particular book, which has a significant place in our history because it is the first book-length study of sexual inversion in Britain, to be published in Britain. And again, that book was also banned, so there's a kind of shared history of censorship here as well that connects Symonds and Ellis and Radcliffe Hall. So Hall reads this book 30 years after it was published, roughly, and she draws on that terminology and that category of sexual inversion, and the sexual invert becomes the term, or is the term, that she uses when she talks about Stephen Gordon in The Well of Loneliness. And in particular, I guess, The Well of Loneliness has become really important because it circulates two ideas that, for better or worse, are still with us today. The first idea is that lesbianism is somehow linked, intrinsically linked to masculinity. So this idea of the masculine lesbian is something that you get in The Well of Loneliness, and Hall herself came to embody that as well. And also the idea that homosexuality is what was called congenital, inborn, biologically defined, fixed, a kind of essential part of the self, not a choice, but something we are born with. That idea, still very powerful today, Hall takes from sexology, but circulates and popularizes in that book, The Well of Loneliness. And since it's been banned, The Well of Loneliness, as I said, it's become a lesbian classic. It's still read. It's been in print ever since. These are the two most recent editions that I could find. So if you were to go to Waterstones and buy the book, or to any other bookshop, those are the books that you would find. I love the cover, the Penguin one in particular. It has that lovely Romaine Brooks portrait. It's called Peter, a Young English Girl. That's the cover there. So people are still marketing it and trying to make it try to appeal to a contemporary audience. And Hall is now, of course, remembered as a key figure in both lesbian and trans history. During a lifetime, she carved out a very specific public persona for herself. This is one of the most iconic publicity shots, obviously very carefully staged, very interesting the way she presents herself. But this is the way we tend to think of Radcliffe Hall, a very kind of striking appearance, short cropped hair, tailored clothing that might register as masculine to us. She has a cigarette. She has her monocle. You can just see it there on a chain. So this is the kind of Radcliffe Hall that we know. Very interesting scholarship has looked at or tried to understand how would this image, this persona, what would that have meant to people in the 1920s? And it's interesting to say that this kind of masculinity that she projects wouldn't necessarily have been tied to same-sex desire at the time. It could also just signal that Hall was a very fashionable, wealthy woman. This way of dressing, the kind of suit jacket and the skirt, that was very in at the time. If you look at Vogue, you get very similar images. So, of course, she is conveying a sense of her gender identity. She might be communicating something about her sexuality, but at the same time, she's also just telling us, you know, she has money, she's fashionable, she's cutting edge, she's modern. That's something else that she's trying to project. We can also see that she's quite vain, as I said, very aware of her public image. And Una Troubridge, her partner here, similarly, very keen to present a very particular public persona to the world. And before I go any further, I think one point that I want to make early on that's quite crucial is about the language I'm using. As I said earlier, Hall is important in lesbian history, but she's also important in trans history. And there's been a lot of debate recently about how we should read Radcliffe Hall and whether we should read her as a key character in lesbian history or whether it wouldn't make more sense to actually look at her as a trans man. And I'm using female pronouns today, but that doesn't mean that I am against those debates or that I want to reject that approach. I think that is a really crucial approach. In particular, the term sexual inversion crucially conflates gender identity and sexual identity in ways that make it very difficult to say whether that is about lesbian desire or trans identity. So that is something that I just want to state. And I'm very happy to also be challenged on my decision that I'm using female pronouns to talk about her. You might disagree with that, and I'm happy to hear thoughts. The reason why I'm doing that in my talk today, in my book, in my other publications about Hall is that if you look at her publications, and if you look at her writing, even the most intimate personal writings that we can find, her own letters, her own diary entries, and letters that other people wrote to her, her lovers, her partners, or the biography that Una Troubridge writes, they all use female pronouns. Hall used female pronouns herself. So I'm using them, I guess, to try to do justice to that, but I know it is problematic, and my aim is not to reject the idea that we should also look at Radcliffe Hall's place in trans history. In fact, if anything, I guess one of the points I want to make today is that why I think working on that moment, the late 19th, early 20th century, is so interesting and so relevant today is that the categories, the labels, the terms that we are used to today, that we use, don't necessarily hold. And that historical moment, the writing that it produces, including Radcliffe Hall's work, can offer us access to more nuanced, complicated, conflicted, but also interesting ways to think about gender and sexuality. So that's something that I wanted to state early on. So as I said, enough about the Well of Loneliness. Let's move beyond the Well of Loneliness. This is a picture of Radcliffe Hall early on in the 1920s, at the time when she was starting to become a novelist, starting to publish her first novels. And it is important to say that before the Well of Loneliness, Hall was a very well-known, very famous, well-established middle-brow novelist. She was very popular. She won several prestigious prizes, like the James Tate Award from Edinburgh, for instance. So she was very well-established and very well-known, widely read. And so I think looking at that earlier Radcliffe Hall before the Well of Loneliness, is a really important part of the story that we need to get back to. And this is also where my archival research comes in, because it is exactly that earlier period of her life that we get access to if we look at the archive, and that is also worth remembering. So a quick sense, I'm trying to take you through a journey of the kind of archival materials that we find when we go to Austin and have a look and go through all these boxes and folders there. So some of the stuff that's there is there are letters. We don't have that much correspondence from Hall or to Hall, but there are some letters there. This is one that she writes to Havelock Ellis, the sexologist, in 1928. And you can see at the beginning, she's actually trying to charm him by sending him some handkerchiefs. Ellis did not have that much money. Radcliffe Hall did, so she's trying to kind of charm him here because she really wanted him to write a preface for the Well of Loneliness, which he didn't want to do. The publisher put it in anyway, which was quite controversial. Ellis wasn't happy with that. But she's trying here to send him some gifts and get him to endorse her work. Other material in the archive includes these books of clippings, newspaper clippings that Una Troubridge and Radcliffe Hall collected. Again, a sense of vanity coming through here. They are massive books, and every little article is represented here. Very interesting to get a sense of how Radcliffe Hall was seen. So these are articles about her winning a really crucial literary prize in the 1927, the year before the Well of Loneliness. And interesting to see here already the kind of speculation about her gender identity. Who is this man, for instance? And here another page, male or female. So very interesting to look at these earlier clippings. There are also interesting notebooks, and I love going through these. So this is one of the notebooks that she uses when she is writing The Well of Loneliness, And her writing is not that easy to read, but basically she's listing here the contents of a sexual invert's pocket. So thinking about Stephen Gordon, sexual invert, what would this person carry in their pocket? And some of the things she lists here are a love letter from a present one, then also a check returned by the present love that the invert is keeping as a token, 3 snapshots of the last love, then also a letter from mother at home, which I think is very sweet, but also lipstick, a powder box, a latch key, and some shillings and 3 coppers. So interesting here the way she's developing the kind of character of the sexual invert. Also, I mean, as you can see here, some of the material is very damaged by water and mold. Keeping archival materials in a suitcase isn't the best idea. So some of the stuff, actually, you can't even separate the pages anymore. So it's quite frustrating. But this, for instance, is a play that she wrote. And before I came across this, there's no evidence. No one really knew that she also tried her hand at writing plays, trying to be a playwright as well. So that is quite interesting. But thankfully, in addition to these damaged drafts, there is also a lot of material that you can read once you get used to a very difficult handwriting. There's some speculation that Hall might have been dyslexic. That's not a term that she uses, but her spelling is very tricky, and she very much relied on her partners and later on secretaries to type the manuscripts and help her get them into print, which is important to remember as well. So some of the materials that I selected for this book, the book basically includes 9 new short stories, 10 chapters of a novel that she didn't finish, but there's enough here to give us a sense of where she was going, and also some unpublished materials and earlier drafts of The Well of Loneliness and another later short story that I'll mention in a second. So a lot of material here that gives us a sense of how productive she was and how she tried to write across a number of genres using different styles, different approaches. And in the talk today, I'll focus on what those materials tell us about the way or the ways, the different ways that she thought about gender and sexuality. And this is the cover I chose. This is a portrait in the National Portrait Gallery. If you go there now, it's prominently displayed in a room on World War I. I'm never quite sure why they put her there. She didn't really have that much to do with World War I, but she would have been thrilled. I mean, she was very patriotic. She would love to be in exactly that room. What's interesting there is that when I first went to London years ago when I was 16 and I really wanted to see that portrait, it was very much hidden away in a corridor behind some stairs. I had to ask loads of people with my English, which was horrible at the time, and trying to get at this portrait. So it was on display, but very hidden. Now it's very prominent. Everyone can see it, which I think is wonderful, and she would have been thrilled with that as well, of course. So that is quite nice. I chose the cover also because it is an earlier version of Radcliffe Hall. There are subtle differences here, but quite striking differences in the way she looks compared to the later Radcliffe Hall of the late 1920s, early 30s that we are more familiar with. And I'm interested in getting back to that earlier Radcliffe Hall who was really searching and struggling and trying out these different ways to think about gender and sexuality and a number of other issues. But those are the ones I'm focusing on today. So Hall, at this time, was already in her 30s. It was only when she was 34 years old that she actually said, okay, I'm going to be a writer. Quite late, but she had wealth. She was rich. She was independent. She didn't really have to work. And it was at the time when she was 34 years old, and this is a picture from that time, when she actually decided to become a writer and take that seriously. At this time, she was with a woman called Mabel Betton, whom she called Lady. That's the woman holding that parrot, interestingly enough. So this is a picture taken around 1914, 1915, when she was with Mabel Betton. And Betton was a moderately well-known singer. She met Radcliffe Hall early on. She was much older, 24 years older, and she was really the first serious relationship that Radcliffe Hall had. And Betton was very crucial in facilitating Hall's development as a writer. She very much supported her, encouraged her, helped her. I had a chance, these are not very professional looking pictures, that's because I had a chance to look at Betton's diaries, but they are still privately owned. So they're owned by Cara Lancaster, who is her granddaughter. And I basically spent a day sitting in her kitchen. She was very kind and generous, letting me look at those materials. But what you can see here is, for instance, Mabel Batten talking here about how she's copying out Jade, that's John, that's the name Radcliffe Hall used, copying out John's manuscripts of her story, The Recording Angel. On the right-hand side, she's talking about how she's reading out certain stories to a friend, some of John's stories. So she read them out loud, so very much helping Radcliffe Hall and supporting her in her attempts to become a writer. So very interesting to look at those. So some of the material that I found and that I'm including, that I've included in this book, are these earlier stories, the first attempts that Radcliffe Hall made in writing short fiction, short stories. And some of the stuff you find in the archive, it's not always necessarily very pleasant. There's one short story called The Career of Mark Anthony Brakes, which I did include in the book, but it's shockingly racist. It's a completely racist text. I published this book with a very long introductory chapter where I'm trying to place these stories in the historical context, and you can explain where Hall's thinking is coming from. But at the same time, I mean, the fact remains that it is a racist text, but I think those are also sources that we need to include, and you have to make those decisions when you edit a text like that. But that's there. Another story that I included and that I think is very interesting is, again, an early short story written in January 1915, called The Modern Miss Thompson. And why that story is so interesting is because it offers us a whole different sense of Radcliffe Hall's feminist politics. That might surprise you. Radcliffe Hall is not known as a feminist thinker. If anything, she's seen as someone who was very conservative, traditional in her gender politics, very much opposed to especially the militant, radical suffragette politics of her time. And that is true. At the same time, she was friends with people like Ethel Smyth and other feminist thinkers. And in this story, you get a much more nuanced engagement with feminist politics. So it's a story about a young woman called Angela Thompson, who is very much a new woman, represents the figure of the new woman, a kind of emancipated young woman. She studied at Oxford. But she's just moved back with her parents, who represent the old Victorian traditional order. And Hall is interested here in the kind of intergenerational conflict, a young modern woman trying to be emancipated and independent, and her parents very much holding her back and worrying about their daughter becoming unsexed. That is the term that the mother uses. So Hall is here very critical. Angela is involved with the suffragettes. She goes to a suffragette meeting, and there's a very thinly veiled reference to Emmeline Pankhurst, whom Hall calls Mrs. Breckenhurst, and that is not a positive portrait of her. But at the same time, Hall is also very sympathetic towards Angela's struggles as a young woman, trying to carve out her own identity, trying to develop a kind of feminist sense of herself in the world and a sense of feminist politics. And Hall very much also sympathetic towards the struggle with these conservative, middle-class, Victorian parents who do not want their daughter to have an independent existence and who are trying to force her into a good marriage and a very stable, conventional life. So Hall working through these ideas here in ways, I think, that show her interest in feminist politics and allow us to move beyond this idea of her just being vehemently opposed to emancipation and the suffrage movement in general. Another set of short stories that Hall writes in the early 1920s, that's the time when she's also starting to publish her novels. There is evidence here that at this time, Hall was actually thinking about putting together a short story collection. She's sending these drafts to her agent, A.M. Heath. We don't really know why that doesn't work out at the time, but the good news for me was that as a result of that process, there are a lot of quite polished, finished drafts there, typewritten drafts that I could use. And what's really interesting about that period is that Hall really begins to engage with questions about gender and sexuality in terms of religion, fantasy, the supernatural, and spirituality. It's fairly well known that Radcliffe Hall converted to Catholicism in 1912. She was formally received into the Roman Catholic Church at this time. And her interest in Catholicism really comes through in this story that I found called The Legend of St. Ethelfleida. I am Catholic by birth or the way I was raised, but I did not know about St. Ethelfleida in contrast to Hall. But apparently I did some research, I talked to people, and she was a medieval saint and an abbess in Romney in Worcestershire, if you've ever heard of St. Ethelfleida. She's not a very well-known saint, so that's quite interesting that Hall would choose this particular story. And I have to say, when I started to read the text, for the first time, I was really excited, because here was this masculine woman living in this convent with all these nuns, and I was really hoping that this would be the medieval version of the Well of Loneliness, and this would kind of be Stephen Gordon's medieval ancestor. That didn't turn out to be the case, and I was disappointed. It's quite interesting when you look at this at the first page. Hall even tries to bring out St. Ethelfleda's masculinity even more. If you look at this passage here, for instance, she crosses out that the voice is, what does she say? That the voice is husky to gruffness, and she replaces that with the voice grows gruff as a man's. So in a way, highlighting St. Ethelfleda's masculinity even more. So I was really expecting something there that might be similar to the Well of Loneliness, but it's not. I mean, there's no overt, explicit reference to lesbian desire. This is not a story about lesbian nuns, as I was hoping. But in a way, that is even more interesting, in a way, because what you get here is a Radcliffe Hall engaging with a masculine woman and female masculinity without linking that to lesbian desire, in the way that we would expect having read The Well of Loneliness. So she's not yet making that connection, at least not in a very explicit sense. So I felt that was ultimately quite interesting as well, that she's not going there in that earlier story. In fact, what she does is she uses that story about this obscure, unknown saint, St. Ethelfleda, to make a feminist point about the fact that we don't tend to remember figures like this, that religious history, Catholic history, Christian history erases these women from the historical record. There's a coda that she adds where she really makes that point about these forgotten figures and women for whom there's no space within the kind of patriarchal historical record and within the church record. So a feminist point here that she's making, indicating her also a critical engagement with religion and Christianity. In addition to Hall's Catholic beliefs, Hall was also interested in spiritualism. Of course, there was a whole wave, a whole interest in spiritualism, the idea of the survival of the soul after death, the possibility of maybe communicating with the dead. There was a whole wave of interest in that after World War I, in the wake of World War I, understandably. Hall didn't really lose anyone in World War I. That's not how she got interested in spirituality or spiritualism. For her, it was all about Mabel Beton. Basically, Hall started to date Una Troubridge before she had broken up with Mabel Beton, so she cheated on Beton with Troubridge, who was Beton's cousin, which made it even worse. And then Beton had a car accident, she had some head injuries, and she died quite unexpectedly. And Hall was so guilt-ridden because of what she had done that she basically turned to spiritualism to communicate with Beton, and to try to basically make herself feel better, and that is how she got interested in that. But she was very involved in spiritualist debates, Troubridge as well, both of them were, trying to communicate with Beton. And so there's something interesting happening here in the fiction that she writes in the late 1910s, early 1920s, where she's playing around with these ideas of having different identities, having different existences across historical and cultural moments, having multiple lives. And that is very much reflected in her supernatural short fiction and the fantastic themes that we get in her writing from the early 1920s. And I've included a number of those stories here as well because they're absolutely fascinating in how she's thinking about gender and sexual identity using these themes of fantasy, religion, supernatural, and spirituality as well. So one very interesting but also peculiar short story that I found, for instance, is Miles. That is the final page of the typescript here. It's interesting. I mean, we tend to focus on the way Hall represents women and female sexuality. She was very interested in male sexuality, masculinity, shifting ideas about masculinity as well. And a number of texts in my book reflect that as well, including the novel The World, which has a male protagonist, and it's really about the kind of breakdown of masculinity in World War I. But this story, Miles, is just absolutely strange and fascinating. So there is a young guy called Miles, and it basically tells the story of how he escapes the arms of a very clingy female lover by literally dissolving into another world. And you can see the ending here where he just kind of disappears, his body dissolves, and he finds himself in another world that Hall calls Ayeverby, so A-Y-E-V-E-R-B-Y. I've never been able to make sense of that. If you have any sense what that might mean or where she might be getting that word. But that world is quite interesting. It looks a bit like ancient Greece, There are those kind of undertones, and Miles has this possibly homoerotic relationship with a male shepherd there as well. Aya Verby is also very much an idealized version of pastoral England, and Miles is also there searching for Thetis, as you can see at the end, that voice is calling him. So it's a very strange, queer, interesting space. It reminds me very much of E.M. Forster's early short story, Albergo Empedocle, which similarly, there's a man on his honeymoon, and he basically finds himself in ancient Greece to escape that marriage to a woman. So a very interesting story. And Hall here similarly draws on tropes of time travel, possibly multiple lives, your existence being split across different worlds and universes, to offer a very queer understanding of Miles' sexuality, which you really can't label in any straightforward sense. So fascinating how she uses fantasy and fantastic tropes to get at that. Another story that uses ideas about time travel, and that's a story that you might know, is one that she publishes later on, 1934, called Miss Ogilvy Finds Herself. And as some of you might know it, after The Will of Loneliness, it's probably Hall's best-known text. The reason for that is that when she publishes it in the early 1930s, she actually labels it as a story about sexual inversion. People at the time really wanted her to write about that again. The Weller was such a scandal that people really wanted her to produce another text about that. So when she publishes that story at that time, she actually adds a little note at the beginning saying, this is another story about a sexual invert, Miss Ogilvy. And it's a story that's, again, about time travel, reincarnation in past lives. Miss Ogilvy is described as a sexual invert, as I said. She's a middle-aged, unmarried woman who serves in an all-female ambulance unit in the First World War. There are some possibly homoerotic attachments to younger women in the unit, but you can also see those as maternal attachments, quite difficult to read. She comes back from the war. She's really bored, doesn't know what to do with herself. Other people make fun of her because she has short hair, and she's quite authoritative. She then decides randomly to go on a trip to an island where all of a sudden she travels in time. She finds herself in the body of a hyper-masculine Stone Age man who has a female partner. They then have sex. I mean, Rector Fall doesn't write about that very explicitly, but it's clear that they have sex in a cave, possibly reproducing. And then the story switches back to the present day where fishermen find the present day Miss Ogilvy dead on the island. So that's the story that she publishes. A quite interesting way here, how Hall uses time travel and reincarnation again to suggest that Ogilvy finds herself in a male body. And understandably, people have read this story in particular to make the case that sexual inversion for her was very much about trans identity and not just same-sex desire. And on that note, actually, the idea of inversion and having multiple lives or past lives, I'm always so struck by this image. This is Una Troubridge sitting at her desk. This image was taken roughly around 1930, so after The Well of Loneliness. And when you look at it here, there's an interesting picture here. So there's this split photo frame. And on the one side, you have Rector Fall. It's a famous shot of hers, the one I showed earlier, actually. On the other side, you have Rector Fall dressed up as what she thinks is a Native American chief. So it's a horrible example of cultural appropriation. It's really not politically correct, but interesting anyway. Hall's mother was American, which gave her an interesting class status, actually. She was rich, but she doesn't really have proper class status in England because of the mother. But she believed, she thought, she liked to think that she might have had Native American ancestors. And so she dressed up as a chief here. And it's quite interesting that there's this portrait here where, again, there's this idea of Hall maybe thinking that she might have had this past life, lived as a male Native American chief. So again, interesting to think how these ideas also began to shape her own identity. She embraced the term sexual invert herself in the late 20s, early 30s to make sense of herself. And again, interesting how the idea of past lives, maybe reincarnation, comes into play here. What was fascinating in the archive, though, going back to the story of Miss Ogilvy, is that I found an unpublished earlier draft of the story that is radically different compared to the published version. This is what it looked like. It's unsurprising, maybe, that no one else has really read this, because it takes you a long time to read Hall's writing and get used to that. But when you do decipher what she's actually saying here, the beginning of the story is very similar. Miss Ogilvy serves in the war, comes back, she's middle-aged masculine woman, the same attachment to younger women in the unit. She goes on a journey in the island. But when it comes to that moment of time travel, Miss Ogilvy finds herself not in the body of a hyper-masculine Stone Age man, but in the body of a really feminine young Stone Age woman. So she time travels, but now into a very feminine female body, possibly reproductive body as well. She has sex with a Stone Age man. Again, there's this notion that this might be a kind of reproductive coupling here, that she might become a mother, that she might produce children, and all of that. And when I read this for the first time, I was absolutely struck by this, because it goes against everything we know of Radcliffe Hall. It's not something you would expect her to do with that middle-aged masculine woman. Woman, to write her into a story like that and to link her with this hyper-feminine body. And in a way, of course, it's shockingly conservative. It's a horribly conservative story in some ways. Why should Miss Ogilvy find herself in this kind of reproductive hyper-feminine body? It very much affirms that idea of reproductive heterosexuality, femininity, motherhood, and so on. On the other hand, and I argue this in more detail in the book, when you historicize what Hall is doing here, there's something interesting where other writers at the time were similarly turning to ideas about motherhood and reproduction to actually make a case about female emancipation and empowerment. So the idea that women could produce children, could produce the future generations, was seen as something that feminists could use to also make a case about women's agency, for instance. And that argument doesn't speak to my feminist sensibilities today, but if you historicize her thinking, I think there is something to be said here about Hall, like other writers, using the language of fertility and reproduction to empower Miss Ogilvy in a certain way. But what's also interesting about that story and looking at the different lives that Miss Ogilvy seems to live is, if you compare to another novel that Hall published called A Saturday Life, which is actually I love this book. I mean, it's my favorite work out of her published works. It's out of print, sadly, but you can still get quite cheap copies, Virago copies, online. And again, this is a novel very much about reincarnation and past lives, and the main character, Sidonia, if anything, I guess, if you wanted to use labels, you could call her a bisexual, genderqueer character. The idea here is, I'm not an expert on Buddhist belief, and I'm happy to learn more if anyone is, but apparently A Saturday Life is the last life that you are born into after a kind of cycle of reincarnation before you enter nirvana, and that is the life that Sidonia is now living. So she has had a rich set of past lives, she's been reincarnated several times, and that explains in that novel why she has this interesting gender identity combining masculine and feminine traits, and also why she desires both men and women. So Hall is using ideas about reincarnation here to get at the complexity of gender and sexual identity. And I think similarly in the early draft of Miss Ogilvy, in which she turns into this hyper-feminine reproductive woman, I guess it's also a very queer character. Ogilvy in the present, you can read her as a single woman, as someone who's not particularly interested in sex. You can read her as a spinster. You can read her as someone who has erotic attachments to other younger women. But then Ogilvy also in that story has a past life in which she is heterosexual and she might have children. She might be pregnant and be a mother and so on. So Hall in this earlier draft is again using ideas about reincarnation, past lives and time travel to really work against the idea that there are these fixed, stable identity categories that we can use. And so if you look at all the different drafts of that Miss Ogilvy story that we have, the published one and the earlier one that I'm publishing in the book, it's impossible to label Ogilvy as either a lesbian or a heterosexual woman or an asexual woman or a cis woman or a trans man. I mean, in a way, she's all of those things, and yet no label really does justice to her identity. And that is something that I thought was absolutely fascinating about looking at these drafts. So to conclude, what can we take away from all of this? What fascinates me the most is the radical openness of Hall's engagement with gender and sexuality in these earlier works and in these unpublished drafts. It's particularly striking because Hall is a figure that we remember as a very rigid personality who is to be credited for, to be blamed with introducing to a wider audience this rigid category of the sexual invert. Someone who wrote about Stephen Gordon as a sexual invert, and as someone who was seemingly incapable of making sense of sexuality without relying on this sexological label that she gets from Alison Simmons. But as I've tried to show, that whole reputation rests on one single book, The Well of Loneliness. And once we move beyond that, looking into the archive, looking at texts like A Saturday Life, we get a completely different sense of who Hall was and how she wrote about gender and sexuality. we see that she tried to write about these issues in a variety of different ways, and ways that go far beyond that very particular model of gender and sexuality that we get in The Well of Loneliness. And there's something very open-ended and fluid about the way that she's writing about gender and sexuality in The Well of Loneliness that really takes her well beyond the sexological thinking of her time. And my aim here is not trying to set up Rector Fall and Simmons as opposites to say how amazing it is that she goes beyond that kind of category of sexual inversion that Simmons, together with Ellis, constructed. I think Simmons would have been very interested in Hall's earlier work. I think in particular he would have been delighted with a story like Miles, with its homoerotic allusion to ancient Greece in particular. And I think the fact, as is the case with Hall, if you look at Ellis and Simmons and their own debates behind sexual inversion, you can see here too that those two men and their correspondents were testing out so many different ideas and really struggling. How are we going to talk about homosexuality, present that idea to a public in the 1890s? And when you look at their correspondence, they are not at all settled on the idea that homosexuality is always and for all people inborn, fixed, a biological given. I mean, Simmons is very open to the idea that sexuality can also be a matter of influence, choice, it can change, it differs across cultures, it differs across history. And so Ellis and Simmons, they were both aware of the fact that there is not just one single model that we can use to make sense of both gender and sexuality. And so it's a shame, both with Ellis and Simmons and with Rector Fall, that when they publish Sexual Inversion and The Well of Loneliness, that they present us with this more rigid category and that more rigid model. And it's interesting to think about why they do that, why they settle on that one idea. I think the reasons for this are largely political. What Ellis, Simmons, and Hall have in common is that they're writing with an agenda, and a very good agenda. I mean, they're trying to improve social political attitudes towards homosexuality, and they are calling for tolerance. And I think it is that model of sexual inversion as inborn, as fixed, as biological, natural, not a matter of choice, the kind of born this way model that we still have today, that they think is going to allow them to achieve that goal. And to some extent, you know, they were quite successful in their strategy if you look at the kind of long-term effects of their work. But what I'm keen to do with my research is to show that the work of a writer like Hall, especially if you go into the archive, really offers you a lot of different ways in which we might make sense of our desires and our identities. And I think that's really important for three reasons. I mean, the first is that it allows us to understand a writer like Rector Fall in a number of different ways, do justice to the complexity of her thinking, and really think about, you know, if she's making a contribution to LGBT history, what is that contribution? And maybe that needs to take us beyond just the focus on what she does with sexual inversion in The Well of Loneliness. So I guess the literary scholar in me is interested in that. Also, work by Rector Fall, Ellis and Simmons, and other people opens up an important window onto the early 20th century, which is such a queer moment, an interesting moment, because the categories that we use today are starting to emerge, they're starting to crystallize, but there's still so many other ways of thinking about gender and sexuality competing, intersecting in interesting ways, and there's still so much room for alternative ways of conceptualizing sexuality and gender, and the historian in me wants to get at that. But finally, I also think that engaging with that historical moment, the literature it produced, the science, the medical writing it produced, can really inspire us and offer us tools and concepts and models that we might also use today to understand better gender diversity and sexual diversity. Thank you.